You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, November 16th, 2017.
Places where we are displacing the natural vegetation and putting large impervious surfaces, we're going to see drastic change in temperatures.
Coming up in the next half hour, Michael Glapp speaks with Indiana University researcher Dana Habib. Habib's research looks at the connection between public health and increasing heat in Indianapolis and other metropolitan areas. Habib's research on urban heat islands is coming up on this week's edition of Big Talk later in the program.
It's currently open enrollment period for the healthcare marketplace. Later in today's program, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks your fellow community members if they have healthcare, and if so, from whom. Again, that's coming up later on Voices in the Street. But first, your daily local headlines.
A month after 1,000 pounds of toxic waste were dumped in Lake Michigan by U.S. Steel, another spill has been reported. According to the letter by the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, 56 pounds of hexavalent chromium were spilled in Lake Michigan by U.S. steel mills along Indiana's northern lakeshore. The Chicago Tribune reports that Indiana environmental regulators were asked by U.S. Steel to, quote, keep the spill a secret, end quote. Employees from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency are reporting that U.S. Steel, which operates mills in East Chicago and Gary, Indiana, dumped over 1,000 pounds of carcinogenic hexavalent chromium into Lake Michigan in April. A second spill of 56 pounds of hexavalent chromium, which occurred earlier this month, was not reported to regulatory agencies. Hexavalent chromium is a highly carcinogenic chemical. U.S. Steel states that the plume in Lake Michigan spilled from a rusty pipe in its steel mill complex. This month's spillage closed Indiana beaches along Lake Michigan, including the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and shut down water intakes from communities in northern Indiana. Chromium and hexavalent chromium were chemicals that helped launch environmental health attorney Aaron Brockovich's career.
Vice President and former Indiana Governor Mike Pence's visit to an Indianapolis Colts game reportedly cost the Indianapolis Police Department over $14,000. According to an open records request filed by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, Pence's visit to Lucas Oil Stadium, which he walked out of after NFL players kneeled to protest the killing of African-American men by police, cost taxpayers nearly a quarter of $1 million, in addition to the cost accrued by the Indianapolis Police Department.
The IU Dance Marathon raised a record-breaking $4.2 million over last weekend for Riley Children's Hospital. The student-run 36-hour dance marathon outraised last year's event by over $50,000. Last year was the first time the marathon had ever raised over $4 million. Kelsey Harding is the media relations chair for the IU Dance Marathon's Public Relations Committee. Harding says all the proceeds go to benefit Riley Hospital for Children.
So this is the highest amount we've ever fundraised. Last year we raised $4.1 million. The year before it was $3.8 million. So it's been going up every year. And each year we hope that we can beat that number and see a total at the end of the marathon that shows that we made even more progress for Riley Hospital.
Harding says every year more dancers and committee members get involved in the student-run dance marathon.
This year we had a little over, I believe, 3,500 students. About 1,000 of those are committee members like myself who joined one of our 18 committees. And then the other 2,000 are dancers who are involved either with a Greek organization, their residence hall, or another club on campus. And then they'll have the opportunity next year to also become a committee member. But, about 3,500 total.
Harding says most of the money comes from friends and families of dancers, and that most of the donations are about $25 or less.
The City of Bloomington's Human Rights Commission is seeking nominations for individuals or groups that have made a difference in improving civil rights, human relations, and civility in the community. Human Rights Commission Director Barbara McKinney says the award is meant to highlight members of the Bloomington community who exemplify a dedication to their fellow human beings.
It's an annual award. We've done it for many years now, and we just think there are a lot of unsung heroes in the city who are doing things to make Bloomington better, who are improving civil rights or civility in our community, and we want to do something to make them, I guess, less unsung. We want to sing their praises a bit.
The deadline to nominate a person or group for the Human Rights Award is December 1st. In the past, the annual Human Rights Award has been given to groups and individuals such as Bloomington United and the Bloomington Police Department's Downtown Resource Officers.
We ask people in the community to make the nominations, or sometimes members of the Human Rights Commission will make nominations as well. We welcome nominations from anybody who's interested in doing so. The nominations are due on December 1st, and we welcome people to use a nomination form online or call me, 349-3429.
The Human Rights Commission selects community members and holds an award ceremony in January. More information, including how to nominate people or a group for the Human Rights Award, is available on the City of Bloomington's website.
The Monroe County Community School Corporation's Food Assistance Program is reporting a boost in donations in November. MCCSC Foundation Director Cyrilla Helm reports that so far this month, the foundations have received donations totaling more than $3,200 in response to a November 8th Herald Times editorial highlighting the food assistance program.
So that's giving the full amount that the foundation has raised in the food assistance account so far since about May of last year forward. In the paper, it was listed as $14,100. We're now up to $17,385.
Superintendent Judy DeMuth says MCCSC will be launching a holiday campaign in support of the program called The Gift of Lunch.
As we look for gifts for the holidays, giving a gift of lunch may be a great way to honor someone that you're supposedly giving a gift for, but contribute to the lunch fund. So look for those advertisements that he'll have out very shortly.
Helm and DeMuth gave their report in the Tuesday evening meeting of the MCCSC school board. The next school board meeting is scheduled for December 19th.
Monroe County's emergency dispatch is on track to implement a new countywide communication system. The Monroe County Council approved an amended 2018 budget for central dispatch in its meeting last night. The amended budget contains an additional $800,000 to help fund the communication system, as well as money to pay for six additional dispatchers. Bloomington Fire Chief Jason Moore was on hand to promote the communications project, saying it should have been implemented years ago.
From my standpoint, this is one of the first steps that we get to making not only the fire service with Monroe County better, but for every citizen to be safer. When I deal on my end of fire-related incidents, we do county drills. Number one problem is communication. Number one. We have failed the two drills that I've been a part of since I've been here. As a county, we have failed emergency communication.
Jeff Schemmer, communications manager for Central Dispatch, says increased funding will support the purchase of new radios, mobile data terminals, and new software. He says the upgrades are meant to unify communication between first responders across the county.
That system allows somebody to get on a radio literally in Bloomington and talk to somebody in northern Indiana. And a lot of the radios that we use, VHF or UHF, are incapable of doing that. So it offers that interoperability. If they respond to a disaster outside the county, they switch to what we call mutual aid frequency. And they would be able to talk to somebody, you know, Bartholomew County or whatever is in the geographical area that we call District 8.
While Schemmer promoted the benefit of statewide intercommunications, County Council Member Cheryl Munson expressed concerns about local communications. Munson says an 800 megahertz signal is not well received in some rural townships. Schemmer maintains complete coverage is unattainable regardless of the system.
While they may have dead areas with 800, what we call dead areas with 800 megahertz, mm-hmm. they've also got dead areas with the radios they currently have now. They've also got dead areas for their cell phones right now.
Yes.
When you go live, you're going to have those issues. Now, when they're on the scene, as far as being able to communicate with each other, we also have what's called a talk around frequency that doesn't rely upon the towers to do that transmission. And it's pretty much a direct talk. So that will take care of a lot of their local communications problem that they have. But even with what we're doing, we're not just going to push out these radios and not continue to monitor it. We're well aware we have dead spots all over the place.
Schemmer suggested dead spots could be mapped and boosters installed on water towers to help overcome the dead spaces. The central dispatch budget is part of the City of Bloomington budget, not the county's, but it requires county approval as part of an interlocal agreement. Council President Ryan Cobine explained the county previously approved a reduced budget based on the percentage of public safety tax revenue emergency dispatch received last year. The amount of public safety tax dollars dedicated to emergency dispatch was recently raised from 29% to 36% by the Monroe County Income Tax Council. County Council member Marty Hawk says some in the county feel that law enforcement is being prioritized over fire departments. Schemmer maintains the additional six staff positions will ensure no one department is prioritized over another. He describes how a four-person dispatch team works.
I'm not minimizing what the fire department does. I'm not minimizing what EMS does, but almost 50% of our workload is law enforcement. The amount of radio traffic that's generated through that time is a lot more than what we deal with within the fire departments.
Thank goodness.
Part of us doing the increasing staffing is helping me address some of the concerns the fire department has. Right now, I've got somebody that monitors a fire frequency. Okay, they're monitoring a fire frequency and a 911 call comes in. They can't not answer the 911 call. Well, let's say the 911 call ends up becoming an EMD call and they have to give CPR instructions. If it's down Chapel Hill Road, Southern Indiana, that's 30 minutes when my people is tied up on the phone. I'm now down to three dispatchers. So I've got a dispatcher that has to answer a 911 call. I've got dispatchers that are handling law enforcement officers with a load of traffic. Oh, and now they've also got to pick up 911 calls. The way we've worked dispatch is we have assigned duties, but everybody's cross-trained, and it works on a domino theory. If somebody gets tied up here, somebody has to pick up their slack. The one thing we can't do is not answer a 911 call.
Schemmer also thinks additional staff will ease employee turnover at Central Dispatch.
To give you an idea, our overtime numbers this year, last year for the total of 2016, because of the way we're currently staffed and have been for a long time, we had 2,366 hours of overtime. That's equivalent to about 295 days. So far this year, we're at 3,206. 400 days of overtime. I've got people that are working more overtime than they get off on vacation.
Councilmember Jeff McKim says though he supports adding staff, he was initially skeptical of the communications project.
I was skeptical at first on the radio project, but I really appreciate, Jeff, you spend a lot of time talking with me about this. I've talked to a number of the fire chiefs and some of the firefighters as well, and I think at this point, I'm really excited to make this kind of strategic investment in public safety. I mean, that's the one, that is the advantage that having this pool of money in a single place in the public safety lit gives us the opportunity to make that kind of strategic investment. And yes, I do understand, as Councilor Hawk said, that it may not be what any given fire department would prefer as their top priority. I think as a county, as a community, It is top priority to make sure that the communications work smoothly throughout the county, and that firefighters aren't left in harm's way due to incompatible systems.
Schemmer says the communication project could be implemented before 2019. For WFHB News, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slotograph and Ben Neoff. Sotograph Neoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington, assisting families and small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or online at slotographlegal.com. Sotograph Neoff, law for business, community, and life.
As our cities and summers grow hotter due to climate change, our most vulnerable residents become even more at risk. Dana Habib is a trained architect and urban designer who's delving into the effects of heat and certain illnesses together and how this mixture may become more deadly as the 21st century goes on. Habib says cities are growing hotter on average than the rest of the surrounding land. WFHB's Michael Glab asks, is there anything we can do to slow the increase? Habib and her colleagues at Indiana University's School of Informatics are seeking answers. Habib joins Glab on this week's edition of Big Talk.
Hi, this is Big Talk. Michael Glab here, my guest this week in the studio, Dana Habib. She studies and teaches about and researches cities, the environment. Dana, thanks for being on Big Talk.
Thank you for having me.
You're hoping soon to study the connection between diabetes and heat causing deaths in the city of Indianapolis. And why Indianapolis?
We're interested in focusing on Indianapolis because it has one of the largest food deserts in the U.S.
And this means?
It means that people don't have access to food. And so they call these areas deserts because there is no access to what they call healthy food. Some places actually call them food swamps because they might have access to some foods such as in grocery stores, but they call them more empty calories. But because of this lack of access to food and specifically healthy food, we see a problem with diabetes.
Diabetes, when it's hot, there's a problem.
Right. And so a lot of my work looks at the impact of heat on vulnerable populations. And so what we see is that people with underlying health conditions such as diabetes or cardiovascular diseases are more susceptible and vulnerable to extreme heat and extreme heat mortality.
You talk about something called urban heat islands. So are cities hotspots now?
That's right. And so when talking and thinking about climate change, we have to think about how climate is changing, not just from a global perspective, but from a regional and local perspective as well. And from a local perspective, our climate in cities are actually getting warmer than they are in their rural surrounding areas. And these temperatures are actually increasing at a faster rate than the rural areas and to the planet as a whole as well.
And now why?
It has to do with how we design and build cities.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically displacing the natural vegetation in areas and replacing them with impervious surfaces such as buildings, parking lots, and streets. And that impervious surfaces acts and to trapping the incoming solar radiation that we have from the sun and also displaces the natural cooling mechanism that vegetation and trees provides to our urban areas.
Now you, I believe that urban policies and plans can mitigate some of the effects of global warming.
Yes, and so we have a lot of responsibility and power in our cities to make changes that can impact global warming, but also climate change at the local level. So when we think about climate change, we want to distinguish between the effect that we're having on the global planet and how we're impacting climate on our local regions. And a lot of those impacts that we can make to the local environment has to do with what we talk about with regard to land cover change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we are changing the land cover, the natural land cover, by building cities and designing and implementing the built environment.
Oh, one of the interesting things that I recall from my big city days is at a certain point, there was a city ordinance that said all flat-topped roofs had to be silver-coated as opposed to the old black tar method of roofing. I think it made a difference.
Yes, so there's a lot of research that's looking at changing the reflectivity of surfaces.
Yeah.
And so what that is doing is that instead of absorbing the radiation from the sun, and what it's doing is reflecting that energy, and so not increasing the temperatures in cities. One of the projects I'm working on is a Sustainable Research Network grant that is funded by the NSF, and it's looking at how a person's immediate environment is impacting their wellness and
mm-hmm.
happiness. But one thing that we're doing is trying to measure the air quality, the heat in these areas, as well as the other urban form characteristics as well. And when we see that temperatures are hot, if we see that air pollution is high, this also impacts a person's comfort level in their built environment.
Now, is Bloomington a hotspot?
We can think that The larger your city, the more that you're going to have a more distinct urban heat island. But what we see in the urban climate research and field is that we have microclimates. Mm-hmm. And so places where we are displacing the natural vegetation and putting large impervious surfaces, we're going to see drastic change in temperatures. And so if we are comparing the downtown area, Bloomington, to a more rural area, we're going to see a temperature change.
Uh-huh.
How much of that is to be, you know, investigated.
But would we be talking about maybe a degree or a half a degree, or would we be talking about 10 degrees?
You know, it wouldn't be as high as 10 degrees.
Okay.
But a degree makes a big difference.
Right.
And so... And depending on where we're looking, if we're looking at large parking lots in the middle of the summer, we're going to see some high temperature swings if we're comparing these in completely rural natural environments.
Heat waves are beginning earlier in the summer now.
That is true in specific areas. So I did a research study where I looked at how heat waves are changing across large U.S. cities in the United States. And I measured whether they are changing with regard to their frequency, their intensity, their season, and that season specifically looking at how early they're starting and how late they're lasting. And the season one was very interesting, especially in specific areas of the country. San Francisco, for example, ranked as what we called a vulnerable city to extreme heat. And a lot of people wouldn't think of San Francisco as a vulnerable city.
Yeah.
But it ranked as having increasing trends above the national average in three of the heat wave characteristics we're examining. And heat wave season was one of those characteristics. Heat waves in San Francisco are actually starting a month and a half earlier compared to 1960 to 2000s. That 1960 heat waves were beginning in the middle of July, and by the 2000s, they were beginning at the beginning of June. And we see this shift in heat wave season creates more instances for vulnerability for residents.
One of the papers that you've worked on talks about what the rate of heat-related deaths will be in the United States by mid-century, mid-21st century. Looks like it's going to go way up.
That's correct. In some instances, we can expect that heat-related deaths can double by the end of the century, and that this increase of exposure to extreme heat is making our communities even more vulnerable. It's something that's important that our communities need to start planning for now in order to reduce the vulnerability of future residents.
And there are things that the cities can do. Do you have any suggestions for them?
Well, yeah. So depending on the location that they're where they're located, areas with sufficient rainfall, we've seen that doing vegetative solutions and strategies can be some of the most effective strategies at reducing local temperatures.
Rooftop gardens,
implementing trees, putting urban forests throughout urban environments. And we're seeing that in large U.S. cities. Chicago, for example, has a very aggressive green roof policy. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles has a commitment to plant over 1 million trees in their urban environment in the near future. And this is all with an emphasis and a mission to combat local temperatures.
Dana, thanks for being on Big Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
IU researcher Dana Habib speaking with WFHB's Michael Glab. That interview and all other previous interviews were or are available after the show on WFHB's website, wfhb.org, and also at electronpencil.com.
Support for WFHB comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, do you have health insurance? Flu season approaches and health insurance is on the mind of many. Open enrollment for plans under the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, started on November 1st and continues through December 15th. The shorter enrollment period represents only one of the administration's steps towards repeal and replace. Consequently, we have asked the question whether you have health insurance and how you are insured.
Yes, I do have health insurance.
Okay. Is it through the health insurance marketplace or is it private?
I'm not actually sure. It's federal, so through my mom's place of work.
Okay. So we'll just say that's through your mother's employer?
Yes, former employer.
Yes, I do.
Is it through the health insurance marketplace, also known as the Affordable Care Act, or is it private?
Private.
Is it through your parents, or are you...
Parents.
Oh, okay. Got it. Do you have health insurance?
I do. My mom has health insurance, and I'm under her plan, so I do not personally own my own health insurance plan.
Is it through the private sector, or is it through the Affordable Care marketplace?
It is through the private sector.
I do not.
You do not? Why is that?
Well, it's offered through my work, but I can't afford it, and also I'm lazy.
I do have health insurance through my parents.
Okay, do you know if it's private or public sector?
It's private sector.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do. I have the Healthy Indiana plan. Okay. With state insurance. It costs me $1 a month because I used to be homeless. I'm going to actually have to reevaluate that and see how much I'm going to have to pay.
Yes.
Is it public or private?
It's public.
So it's to the health insurance marketplace then?
Yes.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Alex Davis and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Von Pervosky. Engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Use your favorite podcasting app, iTunes or whatever else, and have this show delivered to you directly. Just go to the store, search for WFHB Daily Local News, and subscribe to our podcast.
And stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show. It's coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.